Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Kathleen Rooney. Kathleen is an author of several very good books, poetry also, some nonfiction, and she's also a professor at DePaul University in Chicago. But she's written a new book. She's been on our show before talking about her book, Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk. But now we're going to be talking about her new book, which is Cher Ami and Major Whittlesby. So, Kathleen Rooney, With Respect. So, Kathleen, how are you today?
Right. It's a sunny day here in Chicago, and I walked up to the lake with my husband, Martin, who's also a writer, so we really can't complain too much.
Now, I hope that you did not go into the water, because we know that on the beach, you're in trouble over there.
Yes, no, we did not. We went, there's a little section just by Loyola University that's not a beach, but it's just a path, and so that's kind of become our pandemic strolling spot.
Kathleen, I love this book, but I loved our last interview talking about Lillian Boxfish. Very interesting book and a very interesting story behind it and you. So, but some of our listeners may not have heard that. And so tell us about where are you from originally?
Yes, so I consider sort of the western suburbs of Illinois to be my home. I went to high school at Downers Grove North High School. I lived in Woodridge, Illinois, where my parents still live. But I did grow up, you know, prior to, those ages sort of all over. I was born in Beckley, West Virginia, and then I lived in Omaha, Nebraska, and Shreveport, Louisiana. And all that was when I was a young child, but the impressions kind of stuck with me. And I think that early childhood experience of moving around and having to acclimate to new places sort of probably contributed a lot to me being a writer, just finding new landscapes and meeting new people and trying to understand regional differences and things like that.
One of the guests that we had many years ago, actually two of them, come to think of it, got their interest in writing about what they did write about because from an early age, they rode boxcars. They were, one of them was, I think, 13 years old, left home, and rode boxcars all over the country and into Canada. And so he wrote a book about the people that he met. It's a novelized version. And that was unique, let me tell you. And the other fellow did the same thing. I think we used to call that, like Canterbury Tales, peripatetic writers. They move all around and they travel and they have adventures along the way. So that sounds like you.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I certainly didn't think of it at the time, but I still, you know, when it's not a pandemic, I still love to travel, and I love to, you know, people who read Lillian Boxfish know that that's a character who likes to talk to strangers, and I think I feel the same way. I don't know, I've heard a lot of people sort of say that there's like a relief to not being able to talk to strangers now when people are, you know, distancing and wearing masks, and I'm all about public health, but I truly, truly miss striking up chats with people I've never met before. And so that's something that I've always loved and I'm excited to get back to.
My brother is a lawyer also and worked in Washington for many years, but he survived, I think he would probably admit this, when he was young and poor, working as a staffer on the Hill. He survived on going to receptions, great Hollywood, probably Washington receptions, and he got to be a connoisseur. And he brought me along on a couple of these ventures when I was down there, and it was truly amazing, because he could, by the time we had been there a half an hour, he had chatted up half of the people in that in the reception knew where they came from originally, knew what they did, and where they were there, and so on and so forth. And it was great. I watched. I learned. I was never like that. I like talking to people too, but not cold. I need a little time to work into it. But so anyway, you like to talk to people. Was that something that you, if you moved all around during your growing up years, that's got to, for a young kid, shape their ability either to be very collegial, chatty, make friendships quickly, or it puts them into a box in the corner of the room and they hide. So which did it do to you?
I mean, believe it or not, a little bit of both, I think. I feel like I was outgoing as a kid and did make friends easily, but I think this is the writer thing, is that I always also tried to listen more than I talked and tried to observe and understand more than to maybe put myself at the center. And I think, I don't know, I teach at DePaul and a lot of my beginning students, I teach mostly undergrads, intro to creative writing classes, and a common story that they'll turn in at the start of a quarter will be this, you know, piece that has, it'll be fiction, but it'll have a protagonist who's first person, but who's always this outside observer, and they'll have, it's almost like Nick Carraway in Gatsby, where they're just sitting back and watching. And I think that doesn't always work in fiction, and so often I, you know, invite them to revisit it and change the point of view or have more plot or what have you. But I think that's a natural writerly mindset, is this sort of like in it but not of it, or sort of participating but kind of taking notes and kind of thinking things through. And I think that's sort of where I think I still am at. And what's a funny thing, my sister Beth, who also shared my peripatetic childhood, she's a photographer now, a professional photographer, and she and I have talked about a similar thing. You know, the photographer is always there, but, you know, shooting it with their camera, not necessarily making themselves the subject of the photograph.
That's interesting, because a recent guest that I had wrote a book, and he was writing about his life, but he wrote about it in the third person singular, in the course of the book, he was giving intimate thoughts about what happened in a particular situation that this man, you know, this guy who is living this life, and this is what he thought, and it's bringing you into the inside of a person in ways that was very uncomfortable for me. I really didn't like that style, but that doesn't say that you can't do it. It's just that was a difficult thing. Third person singular, third person universal, first person singular, whatever. It can work depending on the quality of the subject matter and the author. I don't know. I like your style. It's well done. But what gets you to write? I mean, okay, you write poetry, you write fiction, you write nonfiction. So why? What gets you to do it?
Yeah, I love that question. You know, like you could publish books upon books of writers' answers to why do I write? But I think for me, a couple of reasons. One, I think writing is thinking. And I think it's a very active, very sort of embodied form of thinking. And so of course, most people are walking around all day, all the time, and I'm not saying you have to write in order to be thinking, but for me, it just really helps me figure out how I feel or where I stand or, you know, what my values are or, you know, what actions I think are necessary. So there's that. But then I also think, and I think I might have mentioned this the last time I was on, but curiosity is my favorite emotion. It's my kind of favorite state of being. And I'm an extremely curious person, which I think goes with, you know, I want to talk to strangers. I want to find out what makes them tick. But I'm very curious about history and very curious about events. And I find writing a really good way to sort of understand them deeply in a way that other stuff just doesn't get me there. And then the last thing is, I think I've been thinking about this a lot lately, just this idea of time passing and getting lost in a flow state. And for me, writing is one of my favorite things to lose myself in. Not that I'm a tortured soul who wants to lose myself, but you know, sometimes it's fun to get a break from yourself mm-hmm. and to spend time with something outside yourself or someone else. And I think writing for me is, you know, writing and walking are probably the two things that really let me enter that state where I like look down and I'm like, oh, I forgot to eat lunch, or look at the time. I've been doing this for 5 hours. So I love that state.
You know, many readers could be probably good writers, because what they do is they can lose themselves in a good book. And the key to, I think, developing that in a young person early is to just really yourself love to tell the story, or tell the book story, have the book tell the story, so that the young reader becomes absorbed in it, and they lose the outside world for just a brief instant, perhaps. The longer their attention span, the longer they can lose themselves and find this interesting new world. The dog, you know, what is it, Spot and Jane and who are the other guy was? Look, Spot.
Spot Run.
Yeah, there you go. Right, spot on. But, all right, so you're right. How much time during a day do you devote to it? Or do you have teaching, obviously, and you've got a life.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm definitely a routine kind of person. I'm a morning person. And I love this question. I love process questions. But I always, when I answer this question, put a caveat ahead of it, because I think sometimes these kinds of answers can sound prescriptive or preachy. So this is just what works for one person. But I'm a very organized person and a very disciplined person. And I get up every morning at 5:30. I meditate, I do some stuff, answer some emails. And then because I'm a morning person, not because I'm virtuous, but just because that's my circadian rhythm, I find it very hard to sleep past 5:30. I know that my best hours, when my mental acuity is sharpest, are usually from about 7 a.m. to about 9:30 a.m. And so I try when I can to make that my writing time. And then after that, I'll go, you know, do other stuff like my teaching, or my, I run a small press, or, you know, just the other day-to-day stuff mm-hmm. that life requires. But for me, I find that like just setting aside that like prime mental time is crucial. And I will add that that's only when I'm working on a project. Sometimes if I'm not doing a novel or I'm not doing a project, I won't write every day. But when I have something to do, I just do it till it's done.
Where do your projects come from?
That's a great question. Should I tell the story, for example, of the origin of Cher Ami, or not yet?
We're going to tell you, we're going to take a break before you do that, but I'm going to ask you to do what very few writers or frankly politicians can do, and that is, or lawyers. Can you distill for me in one, maybe three sentences?
Yeah, I love to solve mysteries. And I think that's where I sort of get my source material and get my, if you want to call it, inspiration or that spark of creativity. And when I say mysteries, I don't necessarily mean like murder mysteries or anything like, you know, what happened to the lost city of Atlantis, although that'd be cool to know. But more just little curiosities of, again, what makes people tick. And so I think... I used to, when I was much younger, want to be a private investigator before, you know, I saw too many detective shows or read too many, you know, Sherlock Holmes stories. And I really, really wanted to be that. And as I've grown up, I even took a private investigator course, but I came to realize that it's much less romantic than you think. And it's a lot of hours sitting in a car or trying to find people doing, you know, kind of petty stuff. So I think being a writer is the way for me to be that romantic idea of a private investigator.
It's interesting. We're going to take a break in a minute, but a prior guest on our show, Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl and other things, I asked her, how can she write these scary stories? I read one of her books prior to the chat, and it scared the hell out of me. I mean, and I'm a lawyer. I've been a prosecutor. I've seen murders. I've been to murder scenes. This one scared me. And she said, well, that's an interesting question. This is early in her career. She said, you know, no one's asked me that, but here's the deal. When I was a little girl, I used to make up stories that would scare myself. I just loved to scare me. And that's what I do now. And I thought, well, you know, whatever floats your boat. I mean, that's as good as anything else. All right, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Kathleen Rooney. And we'll be talking soon about her book called Cheremy and Major Whittlesey. A fascinating book, which I'm going to heartily recommend to people to read. It's very, very good. But this is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we will be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Kathleen Rooney, the author of, among other books, Cheremy and Major Whittlesey. This is a book about the First World War, and it's a unique in its teaching or its telling mechanism, and we'll talk about that in a minute too. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. So, Kathleen, we talked the last time you were with us about a book that has gotten a lot of positive reviews. I recall it was on the New York Times bestseller list, which is always dangerous, which is dangerous. I have friends who are booksellers who say they won't read anything on the New York Times bestseller list, but I do occasionally. And at any rate, yours did very well. Fascinating book about a woman who took a walk. Miss Lillian Boxfish takes a walk. And it is, as I said, kind of the peripatetic wandering around New York and talking to Manhattan and talking to people and recapitulating her life. Great book. Now, this book, on the other hand, is Cher Ami. En français means dear friend, right?
Yes, correct.
And Major Whittlesey. Now, where did you get the idea for this?
So I teach at DePaul, and I teach a class that's actually connected to Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk, and it's called Writer as Urban Walker. And we just sort of look at, you know, historic literary sort of representations of people who walk in cities. And I had a student, Brian Michich, who I always credit where it's due, and he wrote a poem. And it had this throwaway line in it, sort of just about an old man sitting on a park bench, feeding the pigeons. And he said, in a parenthetical aside, but this was no Cher Ami story, - look it up. And I laughed out loud when I read it, because that's like a catchphrase of mine with my students. I always say, like 50 times a day, look it up, because reading teaches us so much, but only if we're active in our reading. And if we just gloss over allusions or references that we don't know, we can't learn. So my whole thing as a teacher.
Stop right there, please stop.
Yeah.
You talked about something which I found in the book and I love myself, which is allusions and literary allusions or philosophical allusions or statements of people, famous people, infamous people, little known people. But in an adjective, you can put in an adjective, and you did this, that has a pack to it. It's packed with meaning. What do you mean? Where did you get that?
Yeah, good question. I think, you know, to kind of go back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, kids reading, and sort of, you use this phrase absorption. And I think Wallace Stevens, who's a poet I love, says that writing is actually a very intense form of reading. And at first that sounds like one of those little riddle-esque statements and you have to kind of chew on it for a bit, but I think it's really true. And, you know, if you're writing, you're of course reading everything that you wrote just in the sentence to make it make sense. But you're also in a way going back and rereading and rethinking everything you read before. So I think that's how my style of, you know, these adjectives or these also allusions and things, just it's really packed because I've always got all this other stuff that I've read that I can put in if I want to.
Okay. I interrupted you because I thought that was important. It's a part of your style that I like very much. But the you're also talking about concentration or absorption in the young reader, teaching them to be absorbed, but also to appreciate researching and looking at not just the initial view that you have of reality, but rather say, okay, I know about World War I. I know everything about World War I. There was these people that did this. Barbara Tuchman wrote a book, The Guns of August, and therefore I know, and I read that, and I know everything is to know. Ha! Yeah. But you had an interest in the First World War, which you developed how?
Yeah. So to I'll finish the thread of that story. I love that interruption. I did look it up and I looked up Cherami, which we'll get into that in a bit. But what blew my mind in Brian's allusion is, like you said, it was something that alluded to a subject that I thought I knew so much about that I had never heard of. And so I've been a lifelong sort of buff of World War I. And I think it's because my dad was in the military, and he, after he sort of, you know, had been in for a while, they asked him to start teaching classes as he had moved up the ranks. And so he would sometimes teach these like military history classes to his, you know, fellow soldiers. And so he, you know, he's not a teacher by profession. He's a hospital administrator with a background in pharmacy, but he has this real passion for history and teaching. And so I think just growing up and, you know, seeing him at the kitchen table surrounded by these books, that's sort of where I got it. And he, you know, he taught, of course, all different wars, you know, the Civil War, World War II, Vietnam. But for whatever reason, the World War I stuff is the stuff that captured my imagination. And I think what it is, I mean, any war I think is hard to make sense of, but in some way the senselessness and futility of World War I is just writ so large. Like when you hear for the first time about trench warfare, and just have that explained to you. Like, I just remember my dad explaining, like, the sides would dig in. They were literally in trenches. They stayed in there until somebody told them to go over the top and get cut down by machine guns. I just, you know, it was that morbid fascination. And so, of course, there's so much more to it than that, but I think that was my initial, I had to try, like I said before, it was a mystery to me that that had happened, and I wanted to understand and try to make sense of that.
And you followed through and you did your research, but where did you come up with the event and the people that formed the story of Cherami and Major Whittlesey?
Yeah, so when I looked up what, you know, Brian had referred to, I found the story of this group of soldiers called the Lost Battalion. And their story, very simply, is that they were a group of soldiers who were in the Meuse-Argonne Forest. It was October of 1918, so getting very close to what we now, in 2020, know was the end of the war, but they didn't know it. So kind of part of the Americans' participation in this final offensive that they hoped would bring an end to this stalemate. So on that day, like so often, this group was given the order, you know, all up and down the line, to advance and never turn back and never surrender till the last man drops. And a bunch of them retreated, but the Lost Battalion, led by Charles Whittlesey, one of my title characters, actually made it. So they became a victim of their own success, of course, because if no one else on the line advances, you're out there alone. And so this group of men became known as the Lost Battalion, not because nobody knew where they were, but because they were lost, like doomed, like fated, like cut off. So the Germans surrounded them in this thing called the pocket, you know, because they were just totally in this little bubble. And so, long story short, they were there for 5 days. They had no extra rations. They had no water. They had tons of wounded. And just when you thought it couldn't get worse, there was a friendly fire incident because, of course, the Americans were trying to shell the Germans, but everything was very primitive. And so that's where the pigeon, my other title character, Cher Ami, comes in. And I knew this from my World War I research, that communications were a challenge, right? They had telephones, but wires were easily cut. They had radio, but two-way radio didn't exist yet. They were very close, but they didn't have it. And so they relied on runners, just guys who would run the trails, but of course they got killed all the time. They had guys in motorcycles, but that was very easy to pick them off. And so pigeons were one of the most safe and fast and reliable means of conveying a message. And so I knew that, but I didn't know that Cher Ami, she was their last pigeon, the only one they had left. So they tied the message about the friendly fire to her in its little canister. And she flew that message and got the friendly fire to stop. And I thought that was fascinating. And just one more little thing about it, that, like, there were so many pigeons that were used in World War I, and we don't know much about them. Just they died, just like the men died, just mass death. But Cher Ami was so important. They knew when she delivered the message to save the lost battalion that they had to save her. So they actually sent her to a medic, stitched her up. Her leg had been shot off. They gave her a little wooden leg. So this was like an exceptional pigeon. And I just became fascinated with that. And I wanted to know why I'd never heard of her till Brian tossed it off.
Well, part of your research reminded me on the good side of what I consider the bad side. I was tasked by my English professors when I was in high school of reading Moby Dick, the book that is 900 pages of whales, 200 pages of which in the middle start off with something like, "Note, gentle reader, let's talk about the history and the biology of whales." And then 200 pages later, they get back into the plot of the story. Legends, stories of people who couldn't read the whole book or couldn't read the 200 pages, and but still wrote stunning reviews and got high grades, are legendary in the people I have talked with. And irritation, because I read the damn thing from cover to cover with the 200 pages because I was a good doobie. But one of the guys in the class ahead of me read the whole book in classic comics. Never read a page of the book, submitted a report and got an A+. I read the whole book and got a B++. I was hurt to the core. At any rate, so, all right, but you did research about this First World War. You obviously told us about the Lost Battalion, which is a legendary story. It was after the war was over. That was Whittlesey. We'll talk about him in a minute, but he was a great hero. But you also, this is the part I seriously really loved, and that is you talk about pigeons with both the reality of studying how a pigeon flies, how a pigeon does things, what their senses are. And then with it all, there's a certain intelligent, I won't say ethereal, but a certain quality of personality of each of these pigeons that gives them life. And I love that. I really love that. So what did you do to find out about pigeons?
I have always been a fan of pigeons, and I think it's because I am the kind of person who loves the underdog, and who likes to try to see something that other people don't like and try to find if there's something to like. And I think, you know, when I was a kid, there was this idea that, you know, it originated in the 60s, way back before I was on the scene, of pigeons as being rats with wings. Mm-hmm. And I hate that phrase because, for one thing, it's mean to rats, who are also pretty interesting.
No. Say it ain't so, Joe.
I know, but we'll save that for another. Pigeons are not. I mean, they're not dirty. They're not dumb. They're not pests. They're this really beautiful creature who, you know, and I think I always like to emphasize that's a recent development, this dislike of pigeons. For thousands of years of human history, pigeons and humans have lived very closely together. I mean, you know, Noah's Ark. I mean, it's a dove, but it's a pigeon that brings back the branch that says that there's land. You know, Genghis Khan had a pigeon post. So did the Emperor of China. Julius Caesar used them as messengers in his conquest of Gaul. So it's like weird that now suddenly there's this animus against pigeons. But anyway, I always loved them. And I think it's partly because I love cities. So it was easy for me once Brian dropped this one off about this World War I pigeon for me to just double down. And the research that I was able to do, and this is something I recommend to writers of historical fiction, is you don't want to just read about your time period. You want to read in your time period. So I didn't want to just read books about pigeons from, you know, 2015. I went back and read these books about pigeon raising and how to train them from, you know, like the 1890s to about the early 1920s, like what these guys who were the pigeon men of the Signal Corps and of the Army would have been raised thinking. And I think that gave me that granular detail that you're talking about and this idea of how they fly, what you feed them, how they have different personalities, how you race them, how you show them. And I think, you know, I think that's why I'm grateful to all those long dead pigeon fanciers for giving me that knowledge.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Kathleen Rooney, who's the author of a great new book called Cher Ami and Major Whittlesey. It's about the First World War and about pigeons and about humans and their interactions. And it's just a fascinating book. I loved it very much. This is John Smetanka with Respect, and we'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Kathleen Rooney, who is the author of a new book called Cher Ami and Major Whittlesey. It's a book about, as I said before, and as we've been talking about, the First World War, and now we're talking about pigeons, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about Major Whittlesey and the command, the lost battalion, so to speak. And we'll find out about the group and what the misunderstandings have been because of the mists of history and the mists of perhaps publicity. Fascinating. So this is John Smetanka with Respect. Kathleen, when we broke, we were talking about your research into pigeons. And I must say that I have, unfortunately, a feeling about pigeons when they kind of waddle around in the streets of Chicago or New York or London, and say, excuse me, hello, are you there? Who are you? Why are you here? Are you dirty? Are you clean? But in your book, you really trace out in a factual, seems hopefully factual way, that many of those illusions are not true. They're much different. They're not dirty. They're not whatever.
It's all true, and I, you know, I might sound like kind of a crazy pigeon lady, but I'll just go for it. I think, you know, some of the things that I learned that really made me love pigeons even more is, and I kind of try to show, you get Cher Ami's childhood, and you also get Major Whittlesey's childhood. I try to show their whole arcs, and so what you kind of see when you're seeing Cher Ami being born and being raised on Wright Farm in England, the way that her parents raise her. Like, pigeons are exceptionally devoted to each other. They mate for life. I mean, if one dies, they will, you know, remarry, so to speak, but they are very faithful to each other. And that's why historically from the Romans on up, they're this symbol of fidelity. So I love that. And then also when they have babies, they're so egalitarian in how they split, you know, the childcare. You know, and I know this, I'm, you know, like very close now in my home to my kitchen where out it opens onto a back porch, and under the eaves while I was writing this, a pigeon family moved in and I got to see this firsthand. So I knew my research was true. They took turns. They laid two eggs and the mother pigeon would sit there all day long and the dad would go out and get food and then they would swap. And at night the mother pigeon would go and they would, you know, tag team sitting on the eggs. And when the pigeons are born, this is the crazy thing. Pigeons are birds. They're not mammals. But they make this substance called pigeon milk. It's not milk. It's just this food substance in their crops. And both parents feed the babies, which I thought was just so, so rare and so interesting. So I think they're, my point, you know, I could go on about pigeon facts, but I'll leave it there. But I think people nowadays, maybe because they don't, you know, see them except in passing, don't know what like sophisticated, intelligent, loving creatures pigeons are.
The device that you used to tell this story, which is pigeons and humans, provided me with an interesting perspective on war and the interrelationship between the animal world and the animal world. That is, the human animal world and the winged animal world. But let's shift over and talk about the human world, animal world that you dealt with. And the focal point is Charles Whittlesey. Fascinating guy, star-crossed, but you wrote about his background. Was that accurate?
Yeah, so I did a lot of research on him, and he's not a very forthcoming guy in the historical record. He didn't leave behind any diaries. He didn't really leave that many letters. Famously, before he took his own life, sadly, he left these letters to the people who would have been closest to him, his parents, his fellow commanding officer. But much of that has been kept secret. And so the thing that I found fascinating about him is that over and over and over again, in mentions of him, they called him a confirmed bachelor. And after he had, he jumped off a ship to take his own life, after that, all the stories said confirmed bachelor, no woman involved. And so to me, because I'm a fiction writer, it suggested that he might have been a gay man. And I thought that was fascinating because not only was he in the public eye as this war hero, and you kind of touched on this, just the level of fame and the level of scrutiny he was under after he came back was, it proved to be unbearable. So I thought it might be interesting if he also had these other things that at the time he wouldn't have been able to lay bare. So I didn't want to rewrite him as some kind of tragic or doomed gay character, because that's a trope, it's a cliche. But I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that might have been the case with Whittlesey. But I can't, you know, it's fiction, so I can't prove it.
Yeah, but he came from, I want to say, a shy background. You wrote him as a shy person, but who learned to develop his outgoing presentation of himself. And that stood him in good stead when he ended up in the army and became an officer and a leader. And it was a learned attribute in this fellow. And he came across extremely well. I was, you know, everybody would like to be like a guy like that. He's a guy's guy, and he was a leader, and people respected him. And he was, at least in substantial part, the reason that the Lost Battalion was able to survive. Because they were, I think in the one statistic you gave, there were 600 troops, Americans, who went into battle on this particular part of the line, and they went ahead of everybody else. They were the best, most successful, maybe because of Charles Whittlesey. 600 went in. I think you said 144 walked out, and 160 were wounded and carried out, and the rest died.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that fascinated me is that I agree. I think, and this is true, I can attest to all my research saying that Whittlesey truly was a great leader and much beloved. And I think everything that you could see is that it didn't come naturally to him in the sense that he didn't, it looked like it came naturally, but it was a great force of will. He knew he was this, he was a Harvard educated lawyer. He went to Williams College. He practiced law on Wall Street. So he was moving in this extremely intellectual, if you want to be generous, egg-headed, if you want to be critical kind of world. And so he definitely had to figure out a way. One of the things that was fascinating about the Lost Battalion is it was men from all different backgrounds, all over Manhattan. So you had, immigrants who spoke only Italian. You had, people who were coming from such poverty that the first sort of three square meal a day experience they were getting is because they were in the army. And so my sense of him in the research is that he looked at this sort of Rubik's cube and really had to try to figure out what is my leadership style going to be to make all these different guys respect and follow me so that I can keep them safe and do what I've been told to do. And I think hero is a term that can get diluted and it can get thrown around, but I think Charles Whittlesey was an incredible hero for what he did.
Your device of telling the story was to have the perspective from the pigeon and his, her, pardon me, her, her fellow pigeons, each of whom had a name, even some of them great names, President Wilson and Buckshot and others. But especially Cherami told the story of her relationship with her pigeon keepers, but also what it was like to fly over a battlefield and to look down and to see the horror of what was going on in trench warfare. And it sort of gives literally an omniscient, heavenly view, looking down from the sky as to what it was like. But then also you've got Charles Whittlesey, who gives you the on the ground feel. And as you know, as everybody knows, when you're in the midst of something, a happening, whether it's a raid on a dope store, or it's a battle somewhere, or it's a demonstration, or it's in Congress or whatever, when you have people happening, things, the persons who are in the middle of it don't always get the best view. They're surrounded by action and they're doing their best to grab onto it and make sense of it. So, a great device. I like it very much. And it wasn't schmaltzy. That was the other thing. I heard about this thing about the pigeon and I thought, oh my God, we're going to make a cutesy pigeon out of this. Oh, Kathleen, what have you done with your skills and your talents? Very well done. Very well. It was a good device, told a great story, and the relationship between the two was wonderful. So
Yeah, if I can just say, quickly, that compliment means so much to me because I really, really did set out to write both points of views in a way that, to go with the title of this program, had respect. I didn't want to reduce the pigeons to sort of cartoons or sort of, something out of just sort of like a kid's book. And I didn't want to, by juxtaposing pigeons with Whittlesey, in any way cheapen what he did or what he went through. And so thank you so much. I tried really hard to let those points of view illuminate each other in the way that you said. So I appreciate that.
well, it's true, and I was amazed at, as I say, I was expecting something quite different, and it turned out well. So congratulations on that. It takes you along. This is another part I liked. It takes you along in a stream, a continuation. Many writers talk about the stream of history. Mark Twain writes about the Mississippi River as the stream of life, and other authors do the same. Flowing water. And this is a flowing interrelationship between people, and particularly interesting part of the animal kingdom, and how they react to each other, and how they almost touch in communication. And it, part of it is the frustration that the last bit of communication they can't get.
And I think, I mean, that's something I think about with animals a lot. And I think, you know, I think people are coming around now to understanding that animals are more sophisticated than we gave them credit for. And, you know, sort of hundreds of years of humans thinking we have dominion over animals is sort of, we're realizing that, you know, maybe they do have language, maybe they do have emotion, and maybe we, you know, just because we can't understand exactly what they're quote unquote saying, doesn't mean they're not saying something. And I think one character that I want to mention that I had a great time with and who I think let me say that without being preachy or being too agenda-y about it is Bill Cavanaugh, who's the Lost Battalion's pigeon man, who I did just make up. I mean, they had pigeon men, but I made this particular one. And, you know, in the book, you sort of see Bill. I mean, he's not Dr. Doolittle. He doesn't talk to the animals, but you see, I think of all the people, he has the closest bond with these birds. And I think that's something, you know, to your point that I was trying to show through Bill.
Well, you've just answered my next question, and that is, in writing, not as a good writer, but listening to other people describe the process, I'm fascinated by how they create. Bill Cavanaugh, a created character, didn't exist, but you used him and created him, and other characters that appeared in this story may not have existed by name, but they might have existed by their function in the world of the First World War. So who's your favorite character here?
Oh my gosh. Favorite character. I mean, I love, of the humans, I would say I really, really love Bill. I think I had so much fun writing him and, you know, trying to figure out what kind of guy he would be. And then of the pigeons, I really, really like, it's a tie between Buckshot and Baby Mine. Buckshot is this pigeon who's kind of just luckless and sort of hapless and sort of doomed, but he provides, I hope, a little bit of comic relief, but also like a serious perspective. And then Baby Mine is Jeremy's love interest, and I had a fun time sort of creating this American pigeon. So. Yeah.
And there's an interesting part of this. We'll take a break now. We'll come back and talk about this blending of nationalities with pigeons and whatnot, because that's also very interesting. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we're talking to Kathleen Rooney, who is the author of a new book called Cher Ami, that means my dear friend or dear friend, and Major Whittlesey, that's the full title of the book, about pigeons and the First World War. We'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Kathleen Rooney, who is a professor of journalism or English writing at DePaul University in Chicago. And by the way, you can, if you wish, to find out more about the writer and as well as her work, you can go to her website, which I think is KathleenRooney.com, and you'll find more about her other works and what interests her, and keep track of how she's doing. Now, Kathleen, of the pigeons, who's your favorite?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I had a great time. I mean, Cher Ami, of course, forever, but of the one who's not the protagonist, I loved President Wilson, who I sort of created as this, you know, the oldest and the wisest pigeon. And I had a really good time sort of striking his blend of knowledgeability with kind of pomposity. You know, he's sort of the elder states pigeon who kind of, when the new pigeons come, sort of tells them how things are. And I think that makes him really charming, and it sometimes makes him a little annoying. And I sort of like his and Cheremy's dynamic.
You know, I've seen books who, especially with my granddaughters, that when we read books about animals and animal yards and farms and jungles and whatnot, and they're beginning at a very young age to appreciate the individuality of these various animals, because that's how the books are written. Rufus goes to Paris or something like that. And so, but in it reminds me somewhat of Animal Farm, George Orwell's Animal Farm, or Charlotte's Web. That is well-written stories that have animals with character traits that have a dynamic which is human. And I want to come back to the first quote of your book. It's by Aristotle. You took a long quote from Aristotle talking about, can you do it from memory, or at least part of it?
I think I have it here on my screen. So if we can just take a minute, I will read it. Because, yeah, I love epigraphs, so I'm so glad you brought it up. So one second. All right, here it is.
Okay, go ahead.
So in the great majority of animals, there are traces of physical qualities and attitudes, which qualities are more markedly differentiated in the case of human beings. For just as we pointed out resemblances in the physical organs, so in a number of animals, we observe gentleness and fierceness, mildness or cross temper, courage or timidity, fear or confidence, high spirits or low cunning, and with regard to intelligence, something akin to sagacity.
Very good. And that was Aristotle, who wrote hundreds of years before before BC, before Christ, in Greece. Great philosopher, leader of much of the development of Western philosophy. So there's another epitaph or epigram at the beginning, which is General Joffre, the French leader of the leader of the French army in the World War. And you've got to read that quote for a minute.
Yeah, so that one is simply, we want men, men, men. And that was him in a letter in 1917 to President Woodrow Wilson.
Which leads me to one of the things which you highlight in this book, the reader has to read this to get its full value, but you talk about the brutality, the wastefulness of human life that occurred in that war, perhaps about more than any other, just complete from the generals, just throw bodies, and hopelessly, but that's all right. We're tossing them on the battleground and let them die. And that business that Joffre says about give me men, 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 he's not talking about people with character. He's talking about bodies. And that's all he's concerned about, apparently.
Yeah, and I love that you picked up on it. And I think, you know, hopefully good epigraphs kind of do that and poise you for that kind of thinking about what happens in the book. And I think, you know, to go all the way back to earlier in the program, I think that's exactly why World War I became, I don't like to say my favorite war, because that's sort of a ghoulish way to put it, but I think the war that I've, ever since I heard about it, been so fascinated with because of that, just, you know, stack them up like cordwood, just the war of attrition, just, you know, even the reason that America got involved is that Europe had sort of quote unquote bled itself white. There was this idea that they had just extinguished so much blood that they weren't going to be able to finish it. And that if America didn't come intervene, it would go on forever until truly like all the men of Europe were dead. And I think that just captured my imagination, this idea of an entire generation of young men being killed. And I think, you know, one of the things I wanted my book to do was to differentiate not just the animals, but the individual humans. And like one more little anecdote, I think my dad's a member of the American Legion and the Downers Grove Post, and it's named after Alexander Bradley Burns, who was the first young man from Downers Grove to be killed in World War One. And growing up, I was always fascinated. They had his picture above the doorway. So whenever we'd go there for bingo or whatever, you would see him, and he looked so young and so handsome and so, you know, stoic and full of promise. And to know that he was killed, and for this war that most people nowadays, you know, World War One is not a popular war. People don't, you know, think about it in the same way they do some others. And I think there's just something so tragic there.
And one of the tragedies about that is that it was so brutal that it led as night the day into the Second World War. And the wrongs or the rights that were developed during the First World War and its immediate and following and postcedents were, unfortunately, the things which motivated the next World War. And even more people were killed. How many Americans fought in the Second World War? The First World War.
Yeah, and the first, you know, I'm not even sure off the bat, but it was way less. I mean, it was 10 million soldiers were killed, but it was a very small fraction that were Americans. It was tiny.
But we sent over millions. We sent millions over. And we sent them over singing Over There by George M. Cohan, which we celebrate in the movie Yankee Doodle Dandy. But when they got over there, they found out that singing was not what you did.
No. And they even re-sang some of the lyrics, you know, once they saw what it was really like. You know, it was, we won't come back till it's over there. And a lot of them changed it to say, we won't come back when it's over there. Because they quickly realized that this was the death sentence. It wasn't fun.
In a number of books that I've read about the run-up to the Second World War, several of them by a great author, Lynn Olson, writes great history books about that period of time. She talks about how people were so repulsed in Europe by war because of the millions and millions of people who were lost in the trench warfare that didn't go anywhere, that they stood back and said, no, we can't stop Hitler. We can't stop him. We'll just make a deal with him. And of course, he created a world of racism and superiority of one group over another, and Deutschland über alles, and so on. And we paid a price again.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's one of the things that fascinated me too, even as a kid, is that it wasn't World War One when it happened. Of course, nobody who fought in it, who watched it being fought in, you know, 1918 would have called it World War One, because they thought very sweetly and naively that it was the war to end all war, you know, so they called it the Great War, but they wouldn't, you know, they quickly would see their error. But it's, I think that's an extra layer of tragedy, is they really, really hoped at first that there wouldn't be any conflict after that, and they were so wrong.
Yeah. Just after, the last thing I would mention is that I have some now, or some interest from a family standpoint, because two uncles of mine fought in the First World War. One was on a destroyer in the Mediterranean, and the other, our family legend, I think it's true, enlisted at age 16, had his 17th birthday in the trenches in France, survived, was not gassed, but it changed his life, and not necessarily in a positive way. And the third cousin, who is also in the army, or the Marines in on the continent. So it has a meaning to our family. At any rate, very interesting book, Kathleen. Always interesting to talk to you. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I suggest people take a look at this book, Cherami and Major Whittlesey. As good as your description of it so far here, it's better when you read it. It's a wonderful book, and congratulations. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Saturday, Sunday, and Thursday. And until next time, remember, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.